Okay, I was asked to speak to you today on Jenin. And I just recently returned from Palestine, and I was supervising an oral history project in Jenin refugee camp and conducting research there for my PhD thesis.
Louder.
Okay. First thing, I mean, there's a lot I could tell you about Jenin. I could start off by telling you that in Jenin camp, Jenin camp has its own ground zero. You know, the site where 160 homes were demolished during the Israeli invasion of April 2002. Another 100 homes rendered uninhabitable, and another 300 partially destroyed. Human Rights Watch estimates that 4,000 individuals, well, refugees in the camp, were rendered homeless, and $28 million damage done to the houses, just to the housing, not leaving aside the infrastructure. Another point about Jenin, from June 2002 to November 2002, we're talking about approximately 5 months, curfew was lifted in Jenin for 1,400 hours, which is the equivalent of 58 days. That's over 5 months. I could tell you about the last time I went to Jenin, which was in December. I had to walk over a steep hillside of a valley on a rainy, cold day with my suitcase, bags, and luggage to enter the city because the Israeli occupation has created, well, essentially besieged cities like Jenin, cutting them off from their villages and towns, and effectively making movement between cities impossible. So you can imagine what that means for the economy in the occupied territories. Jenin is also significant because it's in the northern part of the West Bank, and that's where Israel has begun constructing the so-called separation fence, which more exactly should be called the apartheid wall. And I'll explain more on that later. Finally, one could speak of, to borrow a friend's term, cultural genocide, Israeli destruction of priceless ancient public baths, soap factories, and historic houses in Nablus during the invasion, again, of April 2002. These are all inhumane acts, forms of collective punishment, which are illegal under the Fourth Geneva Convention. Yet none of these facts can convey to you the sense of fear and vulnerability that one feels staying in Jenin, as I did. The Israeli army operates with impunity, and I can tell you as a witness that there are daily military operations happening in the city, assassinations, arrests, raids, brutal use of force from tanks to American-made Apaches, and the like. And all of this goes on unreported in the West, and it's barely even known, you know, in cities outside of Jenin in the occupied territories. So in this sense, Jenin for me is on the other side of silence. But one should ask, you know, what is this silence and can we begin to name it? Why is it that the crimes that are being committed in Jenin and the brutality of the Israeli occupation remains hidden? Firstly, we should recognize that terms like cycle of violence and violence in the Middle East represent euphemisms which have been developed by the corporate media to depoliticize and mask the complexity of what's going on the ground. The Intifada is not a cycle of violence. The Intifada is an anti-colonial struggle directed against Israel's illegal occupation, as well as being directed against the regional and global structures that support Israel's occupation and this form of colonialism. Israel is not simply responding to so-called violence. Israel has launched one of the most massive, brutal anti-insurgency campaigns to quell Palestinian aspirations for self-determination. The Israeli so-called Operation Defensive Shield, April 2002, again, was the largest Israeli military operation in deployment of troops since the 1967 war, which was a war between Israel and the Arab states. So before going on about Jenin, I want to raise 2 points which serve to illustrate sort of the political and ideological structures that perpetuate a silence over what's going on in Palestine. First, let me take you back to the summer of 2001. And I'm sure you all remember the Durban World Conference Against Racism. At this conference, in the NGO forum, over 3,000 organizations in a large campaign spearheaded mainly by Southern NGOs succeeded in including the following statement on the final document, and I quote, "Israel is a racist apartheid state. Israel's brand of apartheid is a crime against humanity and has been characterized by separation, segregation, dispossession, restricted land access, denationalization, and inhumane acts." The NGOs were also successful in including a clause in the final program of action of the conference calling for the launching of an international anti-apartheid movement against Israel, similar to the South African apartheid movement. Now, at the time, you'll remember that there was a massive outpouring of dissent, primarily by the United States, also Canada, and including Western European states. Many left the conference in an attempt to delegitimize the creation of a space at the international level to critique Israel and to place Palestinian rights on the international agenda. This event effectively illustrates that globalization, far from being a sort of love fest of global interdependence and equal access to information, knowledge, and capital, is in fact a deepening not only of capitalist penetration into the South, but is creating new forms of exclusion and new hierarchies and power relations. Israel, which is at the center of U.S. geopolitical interests in the Middle East and its hegemony over the region, has a privileged status in the New World Order, whereas Palestine is relegated to the lower depths of globalization's underworld. In this respect, geopolitical interests represent one of the factors behind the continued silence over Palestine. Now, there's another issue here. If we think back also to Durban, right after Durban, there came September the 11th. And then Israel shamelessly manipulated this event and used so-called terror as a pretext to reoccupy the West Bank. The question here is, why was there such unequivocal silence over Palestine after September the 11th, when just 1 month earlier, organizations, over 3,000 of them, were calling for a movement to support Palestinian rights? And specifically, why were European and North American prominent leftist intellectuals silent when they had spoken out against apartheid in South Africa? Is there a fear of being labeled anti-Semitism? Seemingly on the surface, but I think the problem is much deeper than that. And it's rooted within the European and North American psyche. Intellectuals refuse to criticize Zionism because they have yet to separate it and make a distinction between the tragedy of the Jewish Holocaust and Zionism as a racist settler colonial movement. This is because of their own narcissism. Europe has yet to take responsibility for the Holocaust. The Holocaust poses a threat to Europe and exposes the inherent systematic violence within its modernity. Therefore, intellectuals remain apologetic rather than sustain a critique of Zionism for fear of confronting the Holocaust. I can quote to you from prominent intellectuals, from Derrida to Bourdieu, etc., who approach Palestinians and Israelis as two victims, refusing to see Zionism as a racist colonial enterprise. The effect of this type of refusal, the refusal to distinguish, that is, between Zionism and the Holocaust, is to create a system of representation in which Palestine is simply Israel's other. Palestinians are add-ons, invisible on their own, adjuncts defined wholly by their status as Israel's other. Therefore, Palestinians don't exist in of themselves. They are the ones who are engaged in a cycle of violence with Israel. They are Israel's partners of peace, but not visible on their own. Now, to return to Jenin Camp. Most of you know Jenin because of the resistance that happened and was evident in Jenin Camp during the Israeli invasion of April 2002. At the time, there was a very narrow debate in the media over whether this is or this is not a massacre. This narrow debate not only silenced Palestinian voices and experiences, but ignored the fact that there was war crimes committed on the ground. Most of you have probably forgotten Jenin, and it's probably erased from your consciousness. And the media itself has taken up the euphemism of battle as a way to describe what took place there. But I'm here to tell you that war crimes and crimes against humanity were committed in Jenin. So what happened in Jenin? On April the 3rd, the Israeli forces invaded Jenin, not only with the intention of reoccupying the city, but with the intention of smashing Palestinian resistance groups. For 9 days, fighting broke out, organized around Jenin refugee camp. And effectively, Palestinian groups resisted what was a massive military onslaught consisting of air raids, tanks, F-16 fighter planes, shelling, and missiles from helicopter gunships. Unable to stop the resistance, Israel finally went in with bulldozers and systematically began demolishing houses in the center of the camp where the fighters had congregated. The testimony of the driver of the bulldozer was published in the Israeli newspaper Yedioth Ahronot, I can't pronounce it, excuse me, in which he admitted that he was drinking alcohol and he was demolishing the homes at times without giving families the opportunity to evacuate. And he stated that had he been given the chance, he would have demolished the entire camp. So this is in the Israeli newspaper. It's clear from Jenin that from the Israeli perspective, there is no difference between Palestinian military and civilian targets. Palestinians remain invisible. And from the Zionist perspective, the indigenous population does not have the right to remain on its homeland. During 9 days of fighting, Human Rights Watch documented the extent of the war crimes. Civilians were used as human shields. There was attacking and killing of medical personnel, a failure to distinguish between military and civilian targets, unlawful killing, and summary execution. For instance, there was the case of Jamal Fayed, a 37-year-old man, paralyzed, who was killed when the IDF bulldozed his house on top of him, not allowing his relatives to evacuate him. There's also the case of Jamal Sabbagh, who was shot to death under the control of the IDF while he was obeying their orders to remove his clothes. These are just some of the stories that Human Rights Watch has documented. From April 11th to April 15th, after most of the Palestinian fighters had surrendered, Israel refused to allow international humanitarian organizations access to the camp. There are rumors that bodies were removed by the IDF, but none of this has been corroborated. The official death toll is around 69 Palestinians and approximately 30 Israeli soldiers. Now, the role of the media cannot be ignored in the events that took place in Jenin. By focusing narrowly on whether this was or was not a massacre, the media did three things. Firstly, they systematically ignored and therefore covered up the fact that there were war crimes committed on the ground, and also failed to publicize the fact that Human Rights Watch has documented these cases and has been calling for a war crimes trial. Secondly, by using the term battle to describe Jenin, the media implies equivalence between the Israeli military and the Palestinian resistance forces. It delegitimizes Palestinian right to resist and absolves Israel of its legal and moral responsibility as the occupying power. Moreover, by framing Jenin as a battle, the media effectively perpetuates the myth that this is a cycle of violence and again covers up what happened on the ground. In Jenin, the basic infrastructure of the community was smashed, from the roads to the water pipes to the electricity to the phone lines. This is tremendous and massive damage. By not exposing this, the media again confirms the myth that Palestinians do not exist, and they reinforce the Zionist premise that Palestinians do not belong on their indigenous homeland. By legitimizing what happened in Jenin, the media and the international community send a message to Israel that the next step, which is simply ethnic cleansing, is fine so long as Israel has the right PR campaign. There are 3 points that I want to make before concluding by explaining to you what the apartheid wall is all about. The first is I made a lot of interviews in Jenin camp with the mothers of Shahids, which are martyrs. And the voices of these women, I just want to say, challenges and dispels the racist, cultural, and political appropriation of their suffering and in the Western media and also in Israel's public relations campaign, which depicts these women as irrational and sending their sons to die. Many of these women are completely traumatized. For instance, there was one woman I interviewed who hasn't taken off the dress that she was wearing a year ago when her son became a martyr. Yet these women's voices are also silenced by their own nationalism, which portrays them as celebrating their son's death and doesn't give them space to express their grief. In this respect, nationalism is also a form of violence, but it's also necessary and inescapable for people like the Palestinians. Now, secondly, I want to touch briefly to the question of suicide operations. However morally repugnant you may find this form of resistance, it cannot be critiqued without a critique of Zionism and its refusal to recognize the collective existence of the Palestinians. An Israeli philosopher, Adi Ophir, recently stated at a conference in Nazareth, "The Israeli colonial sovereign is killing with impunity in the occupied territories. Palestinian life is being forsaken on a daily basis, and this has become normalized. The suicide bomber attempts to reclaim the forsaking of life and show that Palestinian life is not meaningless, but it can inflict its own form of punishment. In this respect, my point here is simply that the systematic forces that go into making someone turn to death as a way to find meaning must also be included in the critique of suicide bombings. Finally, there's another point, a related point, which touches on the structures within the Palestinian movement. In the first Intifada, Palestinian resistance was led by popular committees, parties, women's activists, workers, etc. There was a real popular movement. But after the first Intifada, many of these intellectuals, activists, and grassroots leaders were absorbed into a new formation, the NGO. Individuals that are concerned with globalization and its effects should consider the effect of the rise of NGOs in the South, especially on popular movements, and in turn on how these societies organize themselves politically. In Palestine, NGOs have deprived the grassroots of their activists and their intellectuals, who are now turned to the North and to NGO networks and global activism instead of leading their own population. So in a period of national struggle, like in Palestine, you can see the tremendous negative impacts this has on the type of resistance methods that are chosen. Finally, I just conclude by touching on this apartheid wall. The media recently has been reporting on the construction of so-called fence, which is supposedly going to create a unilateral separation between Israel and the occupied territories. This is a complete distortion. The fence is, in fact, an apartheid wall, not only in terms of its size, it's 8 meters high, and its width, which is also very similar to the creation of the Berlin Wall, and it will further divide up the West Bank into hundreds of small entities that cannot sustain themselves and will be more akin to open-air prisons. It will annex agricultural land as well as water resources. Just to give you an example of, I mean, I can't go into all the details here, but for 15 villages will be completely cut off by this apartheid wall, stranded between Israel and the West Bank, and they will need permits to get into the West Bank. Some villages, such as Qalqilia, will be completely encircled by the wall. At the same time, land will be annexed, and Qalqilia will lose 30 to 40% of its water reserves. As a whole, the Palestinians will lose 20% of their water supply because of this wall. Qalqilia will also lose access to its markets, where it sells its goods. And as a result, unemployment is expected to rise to approximately 70%. Overall, the apartheid wall will transform the occupation into a complex system of control consisting of three factors. On the one hand, is a South African apartheid system. Secondly, a U.S. style of policies of segregation which were applied against the African Americans. And thirdly, a policy of policing the indigenous population by pushing them onto reserves. Palestinians will be pushed onto enclaves with limited access to natural resources and even limited means to maintain their own basic subsistence. So I urge you to find out more about the apartheid wall, and there's a website that you can check out. It's www.stopthewall.org. And, challenge this silence and challenge your own racism and speak out.